This is 4:55 on Monday, October 3rd. So those on the recordings, just be aware that there's a, I'm not going to go back over all those things, but that there's a project for assignment is posted, that executables for the Linux, Linux executables for the project are posted, and the project is due next Monday. Yes, question?
On the, did you just hold off on the client?
Pardon?
For the sample response for the client, I think it had the 16-bit string length as part of the requirements. I don't know if I just missed that.
I don't think it is supposed to print that.
Oh, really?
Right.
Okay.
It's part of what comes back, but I don't think it prints that.
Okay.
And if it says to do that, then send me an email and I'll fix it, okay? Because, you know, there are a lot of details, and sometimes you don't even get them right. So let me know. Questions about anything else? Yes, Andrew.
Do you want us to submit an actual makefile, or would a build script work for you?
A build script is fine. Yeah. Those doing it on Windows won't have makefiles, so build scripts is good. I think that's what it says in the assignment, doesn't it? It says a makefile or other way to build the project. Other questions? All right, well then let's launch into talking about the network layer. All right, so chapter 4. Once again, we're using the slides from the textbook authors as the starting point, anyway, for our discussions. So we've done an overview. You know, we did chapter 1 that talked about sort of overall networking service models. Now we're going to talk specifically about the network layer service models, just like we did at the transport layer. There's a couple of terms that you need to be familiar with and understand the distinction between. Those are forwarding and routing. Those are related but different concepts. So we'll go over that. We'll go over how a router works, how the routing process works, and then we'll talk about broadcast and multicast. And then what's going to happen is just about the this project, finish this chapter, it will be time for another project. And your next project is going to be a project in which you actually have many processes running, all talking to each other, running routing algorithms. Okay? So that's where we're headed at the end of this chapter, in addition to the questions that you'll be answering. Okay, so the network layer, remember, its job is packets, datagrams from a sending host to a receiving host. Right? The port numbers are in the transport layer header. The job here is just get it to the host, make the host figure out where it's going from there. Deliver to the transport layer. Yes. And the other difference here, now you got to cast your mind back to the transport layer. Remember in the transport layer, when you looked at the little stacks of protocols at different places, the transport layer only showed up in the end hosts. It didn't show up in the routers along the way. And so that's going to be a difference here. Okay, so there we go. Oh, it's very busy. But there. Alright, so you see it. The end host has transport layer and application. The intermediate ones only have the protocols stack up to the network layer. Now, this is a bit of an idealization, right? Because there are techniques, NAT, network address translation, that we'll talk about, where network level components actually look at the transport layer headers to do part of their job. It's a violation of layering. We talked about layering and how sometimes it was a good thing and sometimes it was a bad thing. And sometimes its badness actually gets in the way of doing what you want to do. So we violate layering sometimes. But the idealization is that transport doesn't exist except at the end hosts. And so as things go through here, somebody had so much fun making those. It's not my thing. All right. So one question you might ask is, as somebody who's going to go off and write network applications, why do I need to know all this stuff about the network layer? Somebody have some thoughts about that? Why do you think it's important to understand about... I'm going to tell you a story about why I think it's important, but what do you think is part of the motivation for wanting to know about the network layer as somebody who's writing applications? I think we've already seen some of it in the transport layer, but go ahead.
Knowing how the underlying system works allows you to optimize your application.
Okay. So knowing how the underlying system works lets you optimize the application for what you're actually encountering. Right? You're not dealing with just the ideals, okay?
When you're troubleshooting problems, you have a deeper understanding of how to fix things.
Okay, so that was going to be the story I was going to tell. So when you're troubleshooting problems, you have a deeper understanding, and I'll tell you a story about that in a second. What else? Well, one other thing that I think of is that if you think back to the socket interface, remember, it actually exposes aspects of the network layer as well as the transport layer. When you're setting up connections, you do binds, right? And the binds require, binds and connects require the network addresses. And some of those addresses are going to be sort of addresses for a single host. Then we're going to talk about broadcast addresses. So aspects of the network itself show through in the socket interface, even though they supposedly don't interact so much with the transport layer. So as an application programmer, you have to know about some of this stuff. So here's my troubleshooting story. Thank you for that, because that's definitely the one that most comes to my mind. When I'm hiring people in the industry, the best thing that for me that I see is somebody who not only knows the surface but knows the underneath, because it's the people who know the underneath who can do the optimization, can do the troubleshooting. So here's the story. Once upon a time, when I was working at Xerox, we had this newfangled Linux or Unix systems coming into our environment. It was new for us at that time, and I don't know, it was probably even a couple of years after we started doing this that we started noticing that some machines, when you booted them, would take a very, very, very long time to boot, but eventually they would boot. But not all machines, and the very, very, very long time was highly variable. And, you know, nobody could figure it out. What was going on? And eventually, by sort of observing the low-level network traffic using a tool like Wireshark, but Wireshark didn't exist then, what I discovered was that there was a service application that lived at the application layer that started up, had to find a server on the network. Happens to be what's called an NIS server or a YP server. Had to find a server on the network. The way it did this was it did a broadcast at the network layer using UDP,
so particular port numbers. And looking
response back from some other server on the network. And what I observed was that this broadcast was eliciting a response from a server on a different network. And the rules of the application were that the server had to be on the same network. So what was going on that was causing this? Well, the broadcast that was supposed to be confined to the network on which it was made was in fact leaking onto another network. There was a misconfigured router. It had the wrong net mask, which is a concept we're going to talk about in here. It had the wrong net mask, and so the broadcast would leak onto another network where there was a much faster server than there was on the current network. And so the broadcast leaked. We got a response back from the wrong server. The client said, that's not a good server, and stopped listening. Okay? So when the answer came back from the local server, it wasn't listening for it anymore. And so it would just go through this process with timeouts over and over again, and eventually the local server would respond faster than the one on the neighboring network, and then we'd make progress, and that's why these machines would hang for a long time. So what's going on here? We have application layer issues in that the application program that's looking for the server is not willing to accept a correct answer after having gotten a wrong answer, essentially. We have the router that is leaking broadcasts, misconfigured, so that's a network layer thing. We have the fact that the server, a separate issue, or on the local network, is so slow. Why is the server so slow? You know, that doesn't make sense. It means we probably have something sort of misconfigured in the way that server is operating as well. So a whole bunch of things show up as a result of being able to look across the different layers. Anyway, thank you for that remark. It was a good lead into my story. Any questions about this? So,
you have to know about the network layer even if you're just writing applications. Okay, so forwarding and routing.
Forwarding is the process by which a packet arrives at a router and gets sent out on some other interface. Okay. So what has to happen for forwarding? The packet arrives, you have to look at it, you have to decide which other interface it's going to go out on. This has to be done how fast? Well, essentially as fast as you could possibly do it. Right? You don't want to impose latencies associated with just inspecting the packet and staring around at your state and eventually forwarding. Rather, you want it to go as fast as you can. Routing is the process by which the routers figure out the answers to those questions about forwarding. It's a much slower process. It evolves over periods of seconds and minutes and even hours sometimes. That you take to figure out what the correct forwards are, and then you record them in tables. So we have a picture. So here's how it goes. When a packet arrives, regardless of what network we're talking about, but say in the case of the internet, we look at the destination address. And say, okay, we've got certain bits there. We look them up in a forwarding table, 0111, and that tells us the output link is to. Okay, very simple. And the only difficulty with this process is that these numbers are 32 bits long, and you have to look up those numbers in a table that doesn't have 32-bit long numbers in it, maybe, and how do you make it go fast? Really, that's the only hard question about forwarding, is how do you make it go fast?
We did that.
Routing, we will come back to. How does this table get built? That's a much more complicated question. And we will come back to that and have
probably a lecture and a half on that whole topic. But forwarding is conceptually simple. Okay. So routing and forwarding are two essential functions of the network layer.
The third one is important in some networks, not in the internet typically, but in some networks, we also have to do
connection setup at layer.
So last chapter, we talked about connection setup at the transport layer. And how did that work? The client sent a packet to the server. We didn't worry about how it would get there. And when it got there, the server did something to sort of start to say, there's a connection being established here, and we sent an answer back, and then once that happened, the connection was more or less fully functional. But it only belongs to the endpoint, the transport layer function, so it only belongs to the endpoint. In some networks, such as ATM networks, frame relay networks, X25 networks, you actually have to do this connection setup at the network layer. And what does that mean? That means that the initiator of the connection, the client typically, sends a packet into the network, and as it goes through every step along the way to the other end, something happens in the network to record the fact that a connection is being established. Okay, so that's the difference. Okay. So those are the three functions. We'll come back to that state that gets set up for a connection in a little bit. At the high level, though, what's the service model for the network layer? Well, sort of the same ones that we've talked about before, possibility, right? You could have guarantees about delivery, you could have guarantees about timing, you could have degrees of guarantees about in-order datagram delivery, non-loss, bandwidth, all kinds of things, right? You could have those. And some networks do. But our favorite network, at least for this class, the internet, look at it. No bandwidth guarantees, no loss guarantees, no order guarantees, no timing guarantees. Amazing that this is the network that has won, in some sense. Why? You've got other networks. ATM is another kind of network. We'll say a little bit about it, but not a whole bunch. It comes with a whole bunch of different service models that you can ask for as part of that connection setup, right? When you start to say, I want a connection through you, ATM network, you can say, I want a constant bit rate. And then it will set up things so that, my goodness, regardless of what happens in the network, you will be able to send your constant bit rate through the network and be assured that all of the packets will arrive at the other end unless something disastrous goes wrong. And by disastrous going wrong, I mean the connection essentially breaks. You have to start over and get a new one. A variable bit rate is similar, except that you say that my bit rate is not going to be constant, and the network has to accommodate that, as well as the fact that you have certain minimums. Available bit rate has a minimum, but doesn't guarantee against loss. Okay, so just a whole bunch of different possibilities. They all sound, you know, many of them sound pretty nice, but this one won. Why?
What? Customization plus the transport layer can deal with some of these problems.
The transport layer can deal with some of these problems, certainly the loss problem and the order problem. It can't really help with the timing and the bandwidth problems, but yes, the transport layer helps. What else? Yep.
It's flexible.
It's very flexible.
And robust as well.
And it's robust on a different dimension than these, right? And in some sense, this doesn't capture what's been important in the internet window. Because I think the other thing that the internet has going for it, relative to all of these as a network layer, is that it's so simple, right? If you want all of these things from your network, you have to build a complicated network. And by comparison, the internet is simple. And so anybody can sort of get in the game when you do internet. And when you try to do stuff like this, it gets a lot more complicated. Why can't everybody have cell phone towers? You know? It's complicated. You can't just go out and start building cell phone towers apart from the radio licensing. Why couldn't, before the days of the internet, everybody have their own telephone system? Well, it had to connect to this thing that was very, very complicated already. And essentially the only people who knew how to do that were the people who already owned the complicated stuff. And what the internet said was, no, it's so simple that a few graduate students in Berkeley could, you know, and they did. What?
No biggie.
No biggie. Exactly. And, you know, they got some things wrong. We talked last time about congestion collapse. That was sort of something they got wrong. But then some other smart person went off and figured out, well, the solution to congestion collapse is actually quite simple. Just do what? Making you remember. What do you have to do to solve congestion collapse?
Slow start.
Okay, so slow start was one component of it, but the more important one was... What? Not start over yet. No. Additive increase, multiplicative decrease, congestion control. Right? That was, you have to go faster slowly and go slower fastly. Okay? So it took somebody to figure that out, but once that's figured out, anybody can do it. It's
just an algorithm. So cool. All right, so
just another dimension of discussion here, really, is that the internet is an example of what's called a datagram service with best effort connectionless service, right? We've said this multiple times. At the network layer, there are no connections. We throw traffic at it, and somehow it goes where it's supposed to go. Or connection-oriented service is one where the network is going to involve a connection before we start. In some sense, these are analogous to TCP and UDP, but they're not the same, right? Because TCP-UDP is end hosts. Here we're talking about the network. Okay, so virtual circuits. So the virtual approach to working really historically has been promoted by the phone companies. You guys are too young to remember the phone companies. Everybody's a phone company now. But the phone companies. Once upon a time, there were like two or three phone companies in the whole United States, and then they got accused of being a monopoly, and so they had to be broken up into regional phone companies, and then there were like 8 or 10 phone companies in the United States, and they were the phone companies. Right. Those folks came from that early tradition that we talked about in the first couple of days of classes. What did we do? We made physical circuits between transmitters and receivers. That was their tradition. And when digital came along, they sort of took that mindset and said, well, let's make virtual circuits. We won't make physical circuits, we'll make virtual circuits. And so their networking proposals were all built around this idea of we do a connection in the network. And the thing that is carried in every packet in that case is not the destination of where it's going, but rather just an identifier that says which virtual it belongs to. Okay? Because once the network knows about virtual circuits, you can use pretty short addresses to name the virtual circuits. And so every router, or they call them switches, but we call switches something else, so complicated. Every router along the way maintains a forwarding table based on the virtual circuit identifiers, VCIs. And so when in one of these systems, when something arrives, the forwarding table says, look at the virtual circuit number. Where is it? Here. And which outgoing interface does it belong to? That one. Off it goes, except that we change the virtual circuit number. Now, why would we do that? So not only do we look at the incoming virtual circuit number here in this table and get the outgoing interface, we also get a different outgoing virtual circuit number. Why do we need to do that? This is a computer science question, not a network. Why would we need to change the virtual circuit number? Any thoughts? It really doesn't work very well if we don't do that. So, why do we need?
Maybe they're being recycled or recreated all the time. So.
Okay, so they're being recreated all the time. That's along the lines of where we need to go. Well, suppose we didn't change the virtual circuit number. What would the consequence of that be? That would mean that every one of these routers had to agree on what all of the virtual circuit numbers were for all of the connections in the network. So we've just taken a process that ought to only involve the routers along the path, and instead turned it into a global problem. So that would not be very good. So what renaming or renumbering the virtual circuits between routers does is it ensures that the virtual circuit numbers are simply an agreement between adjacent routers and not something that has to be globally allocated for the path. Alright? So that's important, because global agreement we saw with DNS, right? Global agreement is not easy to get, and the way you solve that is to delegate. And here the delegation is the adjacent routers, and they just have to agree on the virtual circuit number, and then we're good. Right? Questions about this? So where is that VC number? Where is this?
based on what you know about network protocols and how forwarding works and all that. Where is it? It's in the network layer header, exactly. Right? That's where you expect to find it. Okay. Well, if you're going to have a connection set up, then you need a protocol for setting up connections. We're not going to talk about that because it's not an internet-y thing. Okay. Oh, but we're not going to talk about it except to say that another reason the internet won. Think about UDP and why UDP exists. We said there were a couple reasons. What were they? One was that there might be applications that didn't care about reliable in-order delivery, and that in fact reliable in-order delivery was a cost that they didn't want to pay, right? They came with some overhead. So that was one reason. The other reason was that you might have applications that could get by with a simple exchange of messages. So I send you a message, you send me one back, and we're done, right? And we said, well, why would you use TCP for that? It requires two round trips to make that work. So look here. If our network layer requires connection setup, then even to send a UDP packet, right, we're going to have to incur two round trips. Same problem that you had with TCP at the transport layer also happens at the network layer. So again, this is not a big disadvantage in the way that complexity was, but this is also a disadvantage of this kind of network. So these protocols, or these networking technologies, ATM, frame relay, etc., are used in today's internet, but they're typically used to create specialized links from the internet perspective. We're not talking about the link layer yet, but you take this complicated networking technology, and you use it to build a sort of complicated link from the internet's perspective that can get data from one point on the continent very reliably and very fast. But it's treated from the internet perspective as a link layer, not as a network layer. And that leads to the whole discussion about virtualizing networks and virtualizing links, and we'll talk about that more later. But I don't want this technology as not being useful, because it's very useful, but it's just not used directly as part of the internet, but rather as an underlying piece of the network. Okay, so datagram networks, no setup at the network layer. You feed in packets. They look at what? They look at the destination host address in order to do forwarding. Now this is actually a problem, right? I said before, the whole idea about forwarding is you got to go fast. And the good thing about those virtual circuit identifiers was that they were small numbers and there weren't very many of them. Whereas with the internet, the destination addresses are 32 bits in IPv4 and 128 bits in IPv6. So they're great big numbers. And there's no warning about what you're going to see, right? You might get any one at all of those 4 billion addresses coming at you as a router, and you've got to know what to do with it. Okay? So that's a complication. All right. But it's a solved problem, more or less. So,
same idea. In the arriving packet network header, there's a source, there's a destination address, destination host address. And we somehow look that up in our forwarding table and come up with the outgoing link.
So you can't have all of them, right? You can't have all of the addresses in the table.
Well, these days, you almost could, right? You could almost build a router these days that had all 4 billion IPv4 addresses in it. It would be pretty expensive compared to with the routers that you could buy for $20 on eBay. Because it would have to have, what, 4 billion addresses times 4 bytes, 16 gigabytes of... You could do it, but you know,
wouldn't be a good idea. And that's obviously not how it's done, because we've been doing this for much longer than that has been possible. So, what do we have?
Instead, we have in the forwarding table a bunch of address ranges. Right? So... starting at this address and going to this address, you go to link interface 0. And how do you implement that? Well, you say as long as essentially we make the thing in the forwarding table say, I don't care about these bits. The only thing I care about is the bits here. If that matches, then we'll go out 0. And similarly, if these match, then we'll go out that one, and so on and so forth. Okay? So we're going to get some better pictures of this here in a second. But the idea is we only write down the interesting parts. We don't write down all of the bits of the addresses, just prefixes of the addresses. And there's one other trick that's needed, which is to say that sometimes some of these prefixes have more significant bits in them than others do. And in the case that happens, we look for the longest match in the forwarding table. So take a look at this pair of destination addresses. You look at this number and you compare it with this one. Here's 010. Okay, so it matches that one, and it doesn't match those two, so it's going to be 0. But if you look at this one, it matches both of these, right? It says 00011, which matches that, and it matches that. But it also matches more bits in this one. And so we're going to pick this one. So that's longest matching.
Turns out that's sufficient to do routing. So why would you choose others of these? So we talked about this, right? Thank you for the
suggestions. Elastic service, no strict timing. This is a pretty cool one. We forgot to talk about this one before. The internet design allows link types to be arbitrary. Right? We can implement internet over Wi-Fi, and we can implement internet over cell phone and over wired Ethernet of half a dozen different speeds, and over serial links, and over this and that and the other thing. Somebody even implemented TCP over carrier pigeons once upon a time, just for fun. Right? It
doesn't care about link time. If you do this virtual circuit thing, you have to actually push the network design all the way out to the end systems, which forces design choices about the link layer that the internet approach doesn't do. And so the flexibility here is much higher.
Okay. Well,
actually, this seems to contradict what I just said. It says dumb end systems, telephone, with the complexity inside the network. I sort of disagree with that. I mean, that was the mindset of the people who designed this thing, but the fact of that mindset means that the end systems can't really participate in the network. Right? So their mindset was the end system would be something that you talk to, like a telephone, over essentially an audio, an analog link. And all the digital smarts would be back in the network. And what the internet let us do was push out the digital nature of the network also.
Okay, so the next thing up is what's inside a router, and I think that's probably a good place to stop for today. Are there any questions? I actually have a question for you guys. So, any questions about any of this?
So this is a very high-level discussion that I did today. You know, there wasn't a lot of real strong technical content in it. Do you find that interesting and helpful? Tell me an opinion. should I just tell you to read this stuff instead of talking about it?
No.
Okay. Why?
I mean, if we gotta read it, it's useful to, you know, hear someone talk about it, and then you read it, and you're like, oh, I kind of remember this from class. So that, I don't know. That's helpful for me.
Okay. Others?
Also, it helps to summarize things, you know.
The general impressions and what's really important. The book is actually pretty good about not getting into too many details. There are other networking books where they're just full of details and you can't see the big picture. This book, I think, is better at telling the big picture. Okay, well, we won't throw this lecture out of the plan for the class, though. Because to me, it feels like it goes pretty slow, but it's got some in it. So. Anyway, all right. Well, have a good rest of the day. I will see you Wednesday and hand back to James.
I don't know if I want to.